The sprite's nostrils flared. It must have known, being a creature of Traum, that tools could be weapons, and that weapons were instruments of pain. Still, it kept coming. "Go!" Benji cried, yanking heedlessly against rocks. I didn't. The sprite drew closer. Closer. It shrieked, and the wind carried the horrible knell, and I held my ground, raised my hammer, harnessed all the strength I possessed, and swung. A great fissure, like a burst vein, exploded beneath the tip of my chisel, and a thunderous crack split the air, louder than 100 whips. The granite rock holding Benji hostage split in half, freeing the king's leg. I took him beneath both arms, wrenched him free. Benji let out a gasp, and the sprite kept coming. Stone arms wrapped around me.
"Hold tight to the boy, Bartholomew," came the gargoyle's craggy voice.
He spread his great stone wings, sprang from his feet, and then we were in the air. Wind slapped my face, my arms locked and straining around Benji. He held me too, and the gargoyle held both of us, chuckling to himself as he soared.
"What fun! What a wonderful display of valour on my part!"
He flew us directly over the knights as they cantered toward the mountain sprite. The beast screamed, tried to run, was no match against their swords. They cut it down, and when it fell, the earth shook a final time. Everything went still. The gargoyle coasted over grass, then dropped down upon it. Benji and I fell in a heap, groaning. I coughed. "You all right?"
"I think so."
The king's golden hair was dark with sweat, his ruddy cheeks wan, but his blue eyes were resolute. He took my hand.
"Thank you for staying. You're very brave, Six."
I realized then that Benedict Castor, for just a moment, had thought he was going to die. A boy of 17, with everything in the world still to prove. "Not half as brave as you, Benji." Wind sang through the grass, the hills and road quiet, like it had all been but a terrible dream. I looked back at the knights who were now riding toward us. Behind them, like a hill once more, lay the body of a slain mountain sprite. Something sharp prickled behind my eyes. What do they eat, mountain sprites?
Shale from the peaks.
I turned my gaze on the king. Then surely the right thing to do would be to feed it shale, not kill it. Benji tinkered with his broken greaves.
Likely, but the land we're about to venture into belongs to the noble families of the Fervent Peaks, and they are adamantly against sharing it with sprites.
His straps finally unclasped, and he let out a sigh of relief.
After all, sprites have plagued Traum for centuries. Everyone knows that.
Perhaps, I murmured. Then again, someone rather wise once said, Traum's histories are forged by those who benefit from them, and seldom those who live them. Benji's hands stilled. He looked up at me. But before he could tender a response, the knights closed in around us, dismounting as they came to check on their king. Highfalutin apologies were spouted, the knights sorry not to have noticed their king fall. There were a few chuckles as well, a few heavy exhales, and a healthy amount of profanity, the company glad on all accounts they'd killed the sprite.
"Move!"
Someone was shoving their way through the group, pushing forward with urgent steps. Rory. His face was drawn and without warmth. When he saw Benji and me, and the gargoyle seated in the grass next to one another, whole and unharmed, he put a hand to his mouth, smothering a low sound, then walked away as brusquely as he'd come. Maud picked Benji up out of the grass, looked him over.
"All in one piece?" she asked.
Benji gave a shaky laugh.
"All in one piece?"
Maud clasped his shoulder,
then turned her gaze to me and smiled. Like I'd done something more than save her king. Like she wasn't just pleased, but proud.
You did good.
She nodded at the gargoyle.
You too.
We walked back to the road, which was littered with pieces of our lost cart.
Look, Bartholomew, the gargoyle said, lifting my boots from a bush. Your foot gloves are perfectly unscathed.
Well, what do you know? Maud hauled a large wicker box from a gorse bush.
This too.
What's that? Your pretty waxen hide, she said, unlatching it and showing me my diviner dress, covered in wax, the one she'd cut off me, my precise measurements for armour. Maud gestured at the mould.
I'll sleep better knowing the next time you face down a mountain sprite, you'll be dressed for it. I'll send this to Petula Hall at the outpost ahead. The more time my blacksmith has with it, the better. You have impressive measurements.
My head snapped her way. For a diviner, you mean? She fixed me with a reproving glance. There aren't ghosts in my word, Six. No rot hiding behind the scent of flowers. When I insult you, you'll know it. She nodded at the box. You have a strong body to match a valiant spirit. That was all I meant. Her honesty, bereft of cruelty, shamed me. I can't pay your armourer.
Don't lose your tail feathers. We'll work something out, unless you find your diviners before it's finished.
I'm sure another knight could make use of it if I don't. There was something in her eyes I couldn't read, not derision or hunger or pity.
It's not like your gossamer, shapeless enough to fit anyone. No one's going to wear this armor as well as you.
I realized what it was after she'd walked away. Kindness. There'd been kindness in her eyes.
Chapter 16. What is harrowing is hallowed. By the time we reached the village high within the fervent peaks, it was well into the night. It was raining, the sky stained black by clouds. The gargoyle and I were in a new cart, shoved up against bins that stank of dried meat and barrels that smelled of ale. We'd been travelling at an incline for ages now, up slopes, past hot springs, and into the fervent peaks, the roaring Tenor River never out of sight. There were no cobblestone roads or brick houses. The fervent peaks boasted fishermen, vastly different than those who call the bustling modernity of the Siege home. Here, the road was dirt and rock, the houses wooden and meek. Fishermen's nets hung from walls, torchlight spilled from windows, and open doors were silhouetted by dark figures who watched us pass by. There were no sounds of greeting. Everything, save the tenor and the wind, was quiet. Some of the knights extended their hands in greeting and were answered in kind by men and women wearing utilitarian leather and wool. The only adornment in the village, save instruments of piscary, was a single oar carved into the dark wood of their doors. I murmured the ardent oarsman's creed. Only the oar, only vigour, can divine. The air felt thinner, colder. Sheets of rain stung my face, and I wrapped my arms around myself, looking up at the night sky, wondering if, somewhere, the other diviners were looking up at it too. Our caravan went up and up and up. The cart bottomed out, jerking to a halt. The road stopped upon a wide, lofty plateau where the wind showed its teeth. Maud had said this was where the majority of the peak's occupants dwelled, and I could see a substantial crop of buildings, houses, stables, a hall. They were crude, like the ones on the road, spread out in a great circle. In the centre of the circle, sloshing like a giant wet hart, was a basin of water. I knew at once it wasn't the basin from my dreams. It was too wide, too loud. A roaring waterfall poured into it from a sheer rock face, stirring the water,
never leaving it still enough to appear crystalline. Still, it was beautiful, the moon rippling over its surface, the tenor feeding it water and also taking it away. I stifled a yawn. What hour is it?
Late.
Maud dismounted from the cart. The zealots have waited up, no doubt.
What zealots?
The gargoyle asked. The answer arrived in fisherman's attire. Five figures, wearing leather, wax-coated hoods, nets slung over each of their shoulders, came from the largest of the outbuildings. Torchlight caught in the crags of their aged, unsmiling faces.
King Castor.
They approached the head of the caravan.
Your falcon said you'd arrive yesterday.
Apologies. Benji dismounted, torchlight dancing over his spotless armor. Our business in the siege took longer than expected. The figures introduced themselves and said their names in such a way I understood at once they must be from the Peak's noble families. They were already familiar with Benji, perhaps from when he was a knight, but he was king now. Formalities needed to be observed. A few of the knights came forward, greeting the figures. Hamelin was one of them. He came to a woman who'd introduced herself as Avis Fisher. She had blonde hair and straight white teeth like his, and they embraced. His mother, I supposed. The woman's eyes moved past her son, slamming directly onto me. Then the gargoyle. Then me again.
There's a diviner in your midst.
Yes, Hamelin stepped aside, looked me over the way his mother had. This is Six. She's a friend. Three horses over, Rory snorted. Hamelin bit the inside of his cheek.
The king's friend.
Maud tapped Benji's shoulder. He cleared his throat, addressing the nobles in a tone so polished the words sounded rehearsed.
Circumstances have brought us together. The diviner will be travelling with me as I visit the hamlets. A good sign from the omens. How do you imagine that?
Another noble, a tall, elderly man with a thin face.
Indeed, there are rumours that you garnered five ill portents from the omens not so long ago at Ashling Cathedral, King Castor.
He looked down his nose at Benji.
Perhaps you are too much like your grandfather.
The knights went quiet. Maud and Rory had twin reactions, both bristling, leaning forward, jaws taut.
I don't like your tone.
It was the gargoyle who'd spoken. All eyes turned to him. And while his bat-like face remained cold, his fingers trilled excitedly behind his back. He was enjoying this.
Swords and armor are nothing to stone. A diviner has chosen to walk beside the king, and to question her methods is to question Ashling, and thusly the omens themselves. Is that what you are doing, or is it the altitude that makes you such a mad apple?
Bad apple, I mouthed. The man paled.
I meant no offence to the diviner.
He bowed his head, said through his teeth, nor the king. Rory leaned against Fig.
Is she the only diviner you've seen of late?
The nobles exchanged glances. Yes, Hamelin's mother answered.
Should we expect more?
My stomach fell.
Unlikely.
Rory's gaze flickered to my face. She's a guest of the king's.
Affront her in any way, the knighthood will answer. Attempt to look beneath her shroud, she and the gargoyle will respond as they see fit, with full immunity to any carnage tended.
The gargoyle batted his eyes.
Oh, Bartholomew, he's dreamy.
The knighthood formed a line and moved through the village, the gargoyle and I at the back. We passed between mountain rocks and under torches. I could tell which stones were young and which were old by their smoothness, time and weather, and the constant assault of rain as effective as a grindstone. Torch flames flickered, and an enormous canvas banner of the oar caught the wind, beckoning us with the whipping sounds of flagellation. Benji and his knights moved in a practiced pattern.
a dance I did not know the steps to. They made half a circle, Benji in the heart of it, and the five nobles faced him.
"Torrid and unforgiving," one of the nobles called, fingering the net upon his shoulders. "The river carves a path, always. Only the awe, only vigor, can divine."
Avis Fisher spoke, holding out her net.
"We are said to be the most rudimentary of the hamlets, that our peaks are without gentleness, and so too are we. Perhaps that is true, but to be hardened by our landscape, to know discomfort, and to prevail through it with vigor, is to be close to the ardent oarsman."
Her eyes turned to me, and she nodded, like my presence had assured her.
"What is harrowing is hallowed, is it not, Diviner of Ashling?"
Everyone turned to me. I... Benji's brows perked. "That is..." I cleared my throat. "It is true. What is harrowing is hallowed." I pitched my voice low, in my finest impression of the abbess. "May you, here in the fervent peaks, be witness to the wonders of the omens, pupils of their portents, ever but visitors to their greatness." The nobles nodded. Avis Fisher raised her hands to the starry sky.
"Ever but visitors. Ever but visitors," Benji repeated. "Ever but visitors," the knighthood echoed.
Everyone began to move. We descended crude stairs cut into the rock, so wet and precarious I had to catch the gargoyle's arm to keep from slipping. I heard a low, steady roar. The waterfall. The basin. There were no torches down by the water, only moonlight lit our way. More than one knight stumbled over rocks as we came to the lip of the basin. When we stopped, the knighthood spread into a line. One by one, the five fishermen threw their nets into the basin. Benji began to strip his armor. First off was his helmet, then his gauntlets, his vam braces and pauldrons and breastplate. He set the pieces of his armor on the ground, and one by one the knights picked them up, as if guarding pieces of him. When Benji wore only his padded shirt and pants, he looked like a boy who'd snuck out of bed to meet his first lover under the night sky. But his face was pale, the ruddy quality of his cheeks diminished. He had none of a lover's mischief or ardor. All I could see was dread in his eyes. He stripped his shirt, then lastly his pants, shivering. What the hell is he doing?
Prostrating himself.
Maud's voice was hard, and so were her eyes. The king stood before his knighthood, and the fervent peak's nobles, stark naked. I wanted to turn my head, wanted to look anywhere but at his cold, vulnerable flesh. And I wondered, is this how he felt, watching me in my wet robe, standing in the spring at Ashling? Benji got into the basin. The fishermen's nets were there. Wordless, he swam out to them, wrapped himself within them.
"That water must be freezing," the gargoyle said.
"This is what the king is," Maud murmured. "Subservient, bereft of any creed except to be a witness, a pupil, a visitor to the omens, a symbol of faith."
I shook my head. The nobles make a spectacle of him.
The hamlets care about their spectacles, their gods, their ceremonies, and Benji wants to please them. So for now, that means making a show of playing along. She never took her gaze from the king. I hadn't noticed before, but the straps of her armor were loose, as if she needed to be able to tear it off at any moment. "He won't freeze. He's stronger than he looks."
"How long will the ceremony last?"
"He'll be in that water an hour."
I wrapped my arms around myself, cold to my bones. Then, a warm presence moved to stand behind me, and a hand pressed against the small of my back. I knew without looking who it was. Rory carried a silver flask.
Even with its stopper in, I caught the faint scent of its contents. Sweet rot. Ashling's spring water. Rory dropped his mouth to my ear.
Time to be a good little soldier.
I shivered, turned to the gargoyle. I'll return shortly. Rory took my arm. An unreal whooshing feeling seized my body, and Rory and I went utterly invisible. When we reappeared, we stood away from the basin. Rory set the silver flask upon a stack of shale rocks, undid its stopper, then grasped my arm again, and his coin flew. We landed high upon a ridge between rocks. It had an impressive vista and kept us deep in shadow, directly above the shale where he'd placed the flask.
Our little lure.
Rory let go of me, settled against rocks.
Now we wait.
Our lookout was cloaked in mist. I wrapped the wool cloak Maud had given me under my chin and watched my breath steam out of me.
So.
Rory pulled a stem of idleweed from his cloak, fumbled for flint rock he did not have, then begrudgingly tucked it back.
What do you think of the peaks?
I shushed him with a hiss. We're trying to be covert. He snorted.
Right. Sorry.
I looked out over the vista. After a long pause, Rory's voice quieted.
Thanks for what you did back there, he said. For saving Benji the way you did.
He blew out a breath.
You make a better knight than most.
Don't make fun of me.
I'm not.
I kept silent. Then, back at the siege, when the water sprite bit my hand, you said compassion is a craft, that when it comes to sprites, you try to exact it. My brow knit. That's not a knightly virtue, is it? It's one of yours.
Who said I had virtue?
I glowered through darkness. Rory blew out a breath.
No sprite ever took advantage of me when I was a foundling boy. No sprite ever beat me, used me.
I couldn't see his eyes, but I knew they were on me.
No sprite told me I was special, then hurt me.
I understood exactly what he meant, and I wished I didn't. A light rain began, and I drew my cloak closer around me.
I see you're still not wearing those boots I gave you, Rory said, worried I might take it as a sign of encouragement.
My gaze shot to his dark silhouette. Maud got me those.
Did she?
I said nothing, and he chuckled.
Rest easy, Diviner. I'm well aware I repulse you. No need to get frostbite on your toes to prove it. They're just boots.
I stayed quiet.
You're really not going to talk to me?
Wouldn't want you to get the wrong idea.
I'm full of wrong ideas.
Rory paused.
Is this about what happened in the forge?
Nothing happened in the forge. Silence unspooled between us, pulled taut by the sound of our breathing. It was only because it was too dark out for me to see his expression, or he mine, that I asked, Are you married? Rory coughed.
Come again?
Four fiddled with a married knight. Not on purpose. He didn't tell her he was wed. And I thought, maybe some of you were married and not saying so when you came to Ashling because you thought you were there for our enjoyment, or we for yours.
I heard the slow sound of his exhale. And if I was married, that would, what, bother you?
There was a monster in my gut, scratching its way up my throat. Are you? He took his time answering, like he knew I was suffering and wanted to savor it.
No, Diviner, I'm not.
The monster withdrew, nicking my dignity before settling once more into the pit of my stomach. Is there anyone you fancy? A fellow knight, maybe?
That's not done, Rory murmured. No bed relations within the knighthood.
You said the rules have exceptions. That you becoming a knight is proof of it.
Yes, well, there are a few tenets even I haven't broken. I don't fancy another knight.
I could hear a smile in his voice.
Now be quiet. We're trying to be covert.
I settled against the rock and set my gaze once more upon the flask of spring water below. Somewhere an owl was hooting. I could hear the waterfall roaring in the distance, a steady purr against the night's stillness.
"Was there ever someone you fancied?" Rory asked. "Someone who came to the tour and caught your eye?"
I grinned into the dark. "Why? Would that bother you?" He didn't answer. "I've had a few dalliances. Nothing stuck."
"Why not?"
"Same as your knighthood. Ashling, bars, bedfellows. Any flirtation I had was over before it started. And knowing that nothing would last, I could never..." I stopped short, swallowing embarrassment.
"Never what?"
"Nothing." He didn't let it go.
"Never..."
"I could never get comfortable. Never feel what you're meant to feel. You know, losing oneself with someone else. The unraveling." My face was so warm it hurt. "The little death." He was silent for a beat of my heart. Then two. Three.
"You've never finished?"
"Not with another person." I thought he'd laugh at me, or be incredulous, like he'd been when I told him I didn't have shoes. And that was my own fault, thinking I'd chartered him, that I could predict his derision, or humour, or humanity. He opened another door to himself every time. "Pith, you think there's something wrong with me?"
"I don't."
Rory's voice was gravel.
"I was wondering what it would be like, watching you unravel."
The night was cold, the air thin, and I was thoughtless and breathless. I turned my head away from his silhouette, my pulse clamoring, and saw a shadow move. They looked like rocks at first, grey, textured skin that might easily be mistaken for long pieces of shale, like they'd fallen from the mountains and come to life. But they kept moving, three of them, crawling over nearby rocks with strange, craggy hands. Then they sniffed the air, grey lips spread over jagged teeth, a noise like fracturing stone sounding within their throats. I gasped. Rory was already next to me.
"More sprites.
What are they doing?" He turned his coin between his fingers.
"I don't know."
The sprites crawled over the stones like great shale reptiles, sniffing. Like watchdogs, they circled the flask until, seemingly satisfied, they retreated back into shadow. Rory and I remained entirely still, waiting, watching. Just when the night seemed to return to its idle stillness, a figure came from the dark. Tall, cloaked, hunched, it walked with rigid steps, its long black sleeves draped over some kind of walking stick. The figure retrieved the flask of spring water, threw its head back, and upended its contents in its mouth. Rory's breath caught in my ear, and a great hollowness found my heart. I knew without seeing its face that I was looking down upon a mortal, not a god. An omen, lured out by the smell of Ashling's water. The Ardent Oarsman. Chapter 17. The Ardent Oarsman. The oarsman's stooped posture straightened. I saw then that the object he was leaning on wasn't a walking stick at all. It was a stone oar. The omen sighed a great, rasping breath, dropped the flask, and returned, like the sprites, into shadow. Rory tugged my sleeve. "Come on." The mountain path was wet, precarious. One wrong step and I might slip, fall and splat upon rock like I did in my dreams. But I kept my balance, and Rory his, and the two of us followed like spectres over the ridge, careful not to step within the moon's silver glow, watching the ardent oarsman as he manoeuvred through shadows. We were getting closer to the roaring waterfall. Far in the distance, I could see the shapes of the nobles,
the knighthood, standing at the lip of the water, watching Benji in the nets. And while everyone was looking at the king, no one was watching the waterfall. No one saw the ardent oarsman lift his oar into the waterfall's roaring froth and vanish. Rory and I stopped in our tracks. "The oar," I said. "He can travel through water with it." I threw my head back and measured the roaring waterfall, its mist wetting my hair. "We need to get up there. Can you toss your coin?" Rory was scowling. "It's too high." There was no climbing. The rock face was sheer, slick, and the mountain path ended at our feet. The only way to scale this peak was not to scale it at all. "I have an idea." I turned to Rory. "He might not like it." 5 minutes later, Rory reappeared with a flash of his coin, holding the gargoyle by the wrist.
"Unhand me, you brute!" he wailed, thrashing. "Oh, Bartholomew, thank heavens you're here. I've been abducted!"
I pressed a hand over his stone mouth. "Stop yelling! No, no, do not bite me!" I looked up at the waterfall. "We need you to fly, gargoyle." He was not pleased. He was not pleased when I flattered him, calling him brave, and he was not pleased when Rory grinned at the sight of me grovelling. He was not pleased when he took flight, lifting from his feet and soaring up, up, and over the crest of the waterfall, and he was not pleased when he returned.
"Well?" Rory stopped pacing. "What did you see?"
The gargoyle yawned.
"Nothing of import."
My shoulders fell. "There's nothing up there?"
"There's a flat tableland nestled within the peaks, and a body of water upon it, and an assortment of rocky beasts that lie at the mouth of an ugly stone castle. Like I said, nothing of import."
Rory's head tipped back, like he was praying to the night sky for patience he did not possess. I put my palm to the gargoyle's stone cheek. "Take us up there." He was still sour to be ordered about, but then the gargoyle put one arm around Rory, one around me, and pressed us together so tightly I let out a sound. Rory's front slammed against mine, and when he looked down at me, dark lashes fanned his cheeks. He held out his arms, asked, a little breathless,
"May I?"
I nodded, and he wrapped his arms around my waist. I remembered flying with Benji, the pain, the exertion of keeping someone else from falling. "Tighter," I told Rory, slipping my arms up and around his armored shoulders. His eyes flared, and his grip around my waist grew firmer.
"I'm not going to drop you, Diviner."
The gargoyle sprang into the air. Rory swore, tightening his hold on me, and we met the sky, battered by wind and the waterfall's dampening mist. The gargoyle held fast to us, his wings beating with impressive strength, and when we reached the lip of the waterfall, he glided up and over it, landing us upon a flat tableland that had been impossible to glimpse from below. Our feet hit stone, and the gargoyle's arms retracted from around me. Rory's didn't. He was taking in our surroundings, his cheeks full of colour, his eyes alight, his hair windblown. He looked so... His gaze collided with mine. He let go of my waist, and I his shoulders. I heard the shaky sound of his exhale, and then we both looked away. Fast. Around us, the peaks were indeed like claws fixed upon a seven-fingered hand, and in the palm of that hand, smooth as glass, was a basin. Rory and I and the gargoyle stood upon rocks and looked out over the water. Fed by mountainous snowdrift, this basin was a mother to the waterfall, a mother to the entire Tenor River, and yet it was vast enough to be unmoving, still as the surface of a mirror. Even in the darkness, I was struck by how clear it was. So pure it was, as if we'd sullied it just by looking upon it. Only I had looked upon this water, this basin, before, thousands of times. but always in my dreams. Reflected upon the water, next to the wrinkling visage of the moon, was a castle. Tall and ancient and crude, it was the same grey hue as the mountains, as if whoever had carved it had harvested shale from the peaks themselves. Its entry was lifted, and upon the stone stairwell, leading to a great stone door, sprites. At least 10 of them, the same shale variety that we'd seen earlier. They lay curled around themselves in sleep, their rocky chests rising and falling. My hands fell to the hammer and chisel upon my belt. Should we get the others?
Benji will still be in the water. Wouldn't want to give the oarsmen time to vanish, Rory whispered, stepping forward. No sudden movements, all right?
I say, Bartholomew.
No talking either. He nodded at the stairs. We go very, very quietly.
My feet were silent, and so, so cold upon the castle's stone steps. I held the gargoyle's hand in a vice, and Rory took the other, his right hand balled in a fist around the artful brigand's coin. The three of us walked in a silent, crooked line up the stairs. The shale sprites slept on, their sleeping breaths, low growls. A few stirred, others sniffed the air, rows of teeth peeking behind thin lips. One even stuck out a jagged tongue as I passed, nearly grazing my bare foot. I flinched, tasting my own heartbeat. But none woke. Rory squeezed my hand, kept pulling me forward. Rain pinged against his armor, and then we were past the sprites, up and up, until there were no more stairs to climb. We stood before the weathered castle door. Rory tried the handle. Locked.
Someone ought to knock, the gargoyle whispered.
Rory looked back at the sprites, swallowed, then pounded the door. The clamour resounded in the palm of the mountains, as if he'd knocked on the peaks themselves, and then there was a shuffling of footsteps, a low, terrible creak. The sprites sprang awake, and the castle door opened. From it, darkness spilled, a cloaked figure within it. He was taller than me, taller than Rory, wide in the shoulders and tapered at the waist. From the long spool of his tattered wool sleeve was a hand composed of grey skin and jagged joints. The ardent oarsman clutched his stone oar and looked down upon us. I couldn't see his face. The mouth of his hood was all darkness. Still, I could feel his gaze. When the oarsman spoke, his voice was a low rasp that put a thousand prickles on the back of my neck.
Who comes?
The King's Knight.
Rory stepped forward, lazily hunched. Had I not understood his back, his shoulders tighter than a bowstring, I might have thought him bored.
With a diviner and her gargoyle.
A diviner.
The yeoman said it sluggishly, as if all the surprise had atrophied out of him long ago.
There must be some mistake.
There is no mistake, oarsman. My tongue stuck to the roof of my mouth. I've come for answers.
Rory's voice was dangerously even.
And to take up the mantle.
The oarsman stood eerily still. Slowly, he lifted a hand, withdrew the hood of his cloak. I swallowed a scream. The harried scribe's face had been flesh, but the ardent oarsman's face was akin to the mountain sprites, grey, smooth in some places, and rough in others. His eyes were smooth, pallid, made entirely of limestone. His lips pulled back in a smile, and I saw that his teeth were fangs, shattered, sharpened stone. His gaze lifted between Rory and me and the gargoyle. He lifted his oar, pointing it into the dark castle, and that terrible, serrated smile widened.
Won't you come in?
Not even a flickering candle lent animation to the castle. Dark and full of angles, with no carpet, no hearth, Rory and the gargoyle and I were led into a hall, the sprites stalking in our wake. The east wall was opened up to the night, a low breeze blowing. Through a row of columns, I could see out into the peaks, see the basin of crystalline water and the moon over it. Cold and entirely inhospitable, the hall bore only three adornments: a pool hewn into the stone floor, brimming with water, a throne, grey and lifeless as everything else, and a mountain of gold. There were piles of it, stretching like pillars to the lofty ceilings. Coins, gold trinkets. I even saw the rich colours of jewels. A king's fortune, as vast as the harried scribe's library, all of it covered by a thick layer of dust. "Quite the banquet hall you have," Rory said, the room throwing his echo back at him. Though reaching it proved a bit of a task.
"I built it myself."
The ardent oarsman rounded his pool and stood on one side, while Rory and the gargoyle and I remained on the other.
"Culled granite and shale from the peaks. It took time. I'm no stonemason."
His eerie eyes fell to the hammer and chisel on my belt.
"But I learned a few things from my time upon the tor."
His gaze rose to my face.
"Was it you who left the spring water for me to find?"
I nodded, staring at his heaps of gold. The shale sprites lay down at its base, like dragons protecting their plunder. "Where did you get all your coin?" The ardent oarsman laughed, a rough, barking sound.
"To be feared, to be venerated, to be an omen, bears great influence. And influence is owed affluence. Ashling's gargoyles bring me many riches."
I turned to the bat-like gargoyle, but he merely shook his head.
"'Twas not I."
"What will you do with it?" I asked the oarsman. "Your great wealth."
"Do with it?"
He frowned, as if he did not understand the question.
"Measure time by its growth, I suppose."
Rory scoffed. But the ardent oarsman kept his gaze, unmoving, unblinking on me.
"But you are not like that, are you, diviner? You have not been brought to me like one of Ashling's treasures. You've simply..."
He opened his arms.
"Come, like a little insect, beckoned by a flame."
"I've already said why we've come."
Rory's voice was hot iron.
"The new king is taking up the mantle."
The ardent oarsman ignored him. His focus had drifted, now aimed upon the stone oar in his hand. He smiled at it, showing those horrible teeth, and lowered its handle into the pool, shut his eyes, and vanished. He appeared directly in front of me, took me by the throat, ripped me away from Rory and the gargoyle. I screamed, a sickening rush stirring my stomach, and then I was vanishing with the oarsman, his oar propelling us back across the pool. When my feet hit the ground, his stony grip fell from my throat to my waist, and then he was pulling me backward, onto his body, slamming the both of us into his throne. The sprites rose to their feet and screeched.
"Stay your hand, knight,"
he called in a booming voice. Then, as if only just seeing the coin locked in Rory's grip, the ardent oarsman barked a laugh.
"Where did you get that?" "Nipped it off an omen."
I thought I'd seen hate in Rory's eyes before. I hadn't. Not like this.
"The artful brigand is dead. You're about to join him."
The oarsman snapped his teeth, caging me against him.
"Throw that coin, and I will take a bite out of your diviner's throat, and my pets will do the same to you."
He nodded at the shale sprites.
"One word from me, and they'll eviscerate you." Starving things are loyal when fed.
For some reason, that made him laugh.
I would know.
The gargoyle's wings were spread, his bottom lip trembling as he watched the oarsman's hand return to my throat. And Rory. Rory was looking at me, raw and desperate and intent, like he was trying to tell me something. His gaze flickered to my belt. The oarsman loomed over me.
I can smell it on you, he rasped.
Hard fingers prodded my hips, my ribs and stomach.
Ashling spring water.
His stone eyes were devoid of life, and yet he looked at me with so much hunger.
How much have you swallowed, dreaming in that cathedral of yours?
The omen lowered his mouth to my neck, ran his cold, wet tongue up my throat. He lifted a gnarled finger to my shroud. I slammed my chisel into his leg. An inhuman scream echoed through the hall. Blood spilled onto the throne, onto the floor, and then I was fleeing, sprinting around the pool, throwing myself between Rory and the gargoyle, the three of us bracing for the sprites to attack. They didn't. The ardent oarsman hadn't commanded them. He was too busy wiping his own blood onto his hand, bringing it to his mouth, licking it clean. My words came from the dark dregs at the bottom of my stomach. Tell me the truth. Tell me that you are not a god, that Ashling is a lie. Tell me what has become of my diviners.
Not a god.
He stood from his throne, blood pooling upon the stone seat.
My awe is magic. I dip it in my basin and can change the tide. Folk look to my waters for portents, for food, for vigor. I am Traum's life force, her tenor river, her strength, unceasing and unyielding. What is ungodly about that?
I felt as I had with the harried scribe, as I had in every dream, the animal urge to run. But Rory's hand found mine, and the gargoyle took the other, and suddenly we were bigger than the looming omen in front of us. Tell me where the diviners are, oarsman, I said again.
The river cares not for the rain. Your demands are nothing to me.
But his fingers idled over his oar.
Never say I am not a benevolent god.
His lips were bloody now. He peeled them back in a horrible grin.
I know all about diviners. Ashlings willing, obedient flock. I know where they come from and where they've gone. Stay here with me, and I will tell you everything.
Rory's hand flexed around mine. When I turned, he held my gaze, imploring with his eyes, his taut lips, the overwrought lines of his body, that I refuse the offer. But he said nothing, letting my words alone fill the cavernous space of the ardent oarsman's hall. My voice trembled. I have always been afraid to dream, afraid to be watched by gods who lurked in shadows. It was my greatest shame. I looked over the oarsman's heaps of gold. But now I see you with my eyes. You are not a dream. You're just a man, paid like a king to play-act as a god. A facade, hoarding wealth, yet claiming to starve. You have no love for Traum, its stone-water kingdom, nor for the people who call you hallowed. Your glory may come from Ashling, but it was earned by the dreaming, the drowning, of diviners like me. The truth bolstered me, no matter how horrible it was. You say the river cares not for the rain, but it is the rain that feeds the river. In time, it can even wear away stone. My words were like the fall of my hammer, strong, exact. I am not afraid of you, because without me, you would be nothing. The gargoyle let out a raucous hoot, and Rory. There was a world behind Rory's dark eyes, It was as if he could see everything all at once when he looked at me, and it was far too much, but he wanted all of it. Ahead of us, the ardent oarsman let out a rasping laugh.
Have it your way.
He waved a gnarled hand in the air.
Your diviners are lost. You will never find them, and I will tell you nothing of their fate.
You will.
Rory dragged his gaze off me and faced the omen.
I challenge you to your craft, oarsman, a match of vigor. And when I defeat you, the river will bow to the rain. Your oar will belong to the king, and you will answer the diviner's questions.
My craft?
The omen's fist tightened around his oar, and the sprites stirred, snapping their jaws.
Do you know what that means, knight? A challenge of vigor ends when strength is spent. If no one yields, a match against me is a match to the death.
My stomach twisted. I looked up at Rory. But his gaze was forward, undaunted.
Give me 3 days to prepare.
3 days?
The ardent oarsman spat into his pool of water.
Agreed.
Rory stepped back, leading the gargoyle and me toward the castle door.
One more thing, the omen rasped. Since it is your diviner who requires answers upon my defeat.
He was smiling once more, his jagged teeth coated in blood.
She must be the one to face me.
Chapter 18. Hit me as hard as you can. Encore. The first foe I faced was not high in a crude mountain castle. It was in the room I shared with Maud and the gargoyle, thrown in a clump on the floor. My leather boots. We'd gotten back from the oarsman's castle at dawn. The ceremony was over, Benji out of the water, the knighthood stationed and a bed in the inn atop the mountain's plateau. Rory had knocked on doors until he'd found Maud's.
Get some rest, he'd said, looking at me with a determined hardness. See you in a bit.
I woke hours later, after a fitful nap. Outside, the sky was a patchwork of grey. Maud's bed was next to mine, and the gargoyle was stationed between them with a blanket slung over his head. They were both snoring when I slunk from beneath my covers and faced the boots. 10 minutes later, I was ready to throw them out the window.
Mercy!
The gargoyle pulled his blanket from his eyes.
What's that revolting grunting?
I'm trying to put these on.
Bested by a shoe.
He shuffled over.
I realise we are beginning to lose our faith in signs, but really, Bartholomew, this does not bode well.
I've got on the socks, and the boot lined up perfectly with the bottom of my foot. Only I cannot... I held the boot in one hand and did my best to cram my foot down its neck. It's not sliding in.
What are these little webs?
Laces, you imbecile. He made a high...
Ugh!
Sound, then stuck his nose in the air and would not look at me. I was halfway into the boot, hopping on one foot, grunting and apologizing, when Maud's eyes peeled open. She stared, snorted, and got to work. By the time the three of us quit the room, there was a layer of sweat on my brow and an even heftier one on Maud's. I was wearing boots, a tunic, leggings, and a jerkin above them. The gargoyle, still bad-tempered to be insulted so early after waking, kept his nose high as he hurried ahead, knocking into knights on his way to the stairs. He's fine. I rolled my shoulders, straining against the unfamiliar leather, and stepped right into Rory's path.
Good, you're... up.
His gaze flashed over my body, the shape of me held close in leather. He, too, was in leather, bereft of armor. When his eyes fell to my feet, my boots, he pressed his teeth into his bottom lip.
The diviner, wearing shoes.
My faith is restored. Explains why you're drooling. Maud grinned as she passed us. How's our king?
Still sleeping under a mountain of blankets.
Here. Rory handed me a cup of hot broth. Drink up. We have a hefty day ahead.
An hour later, I was close to throwing it up.
You're slow, Rory called.
He stood at the top of a crooked stairwell that cut up the mountainside to a lookout. The steps were uneven and treacherously steep. If I lost my balance, the fall would be excruciating.
And you're an ass, I shot back. It's not as if the oarsman challenged me to a foot race. Besides,
I spat phlegm dangerously near his boot,
I think I can best a craggy old man.
Rory looked down where I'd spat, nostrils flaring. He shut his eyes, muttered an invocation of profanity.
The ardent oarsman is not old, diviner. He's ancient. We still don't know everything that oar can do. He'll have no obstacle sending it through your skull if your feet remain idle.
His voice hardened.
I don't want him touching you like he did last night. I don't want him within a fucking mile of you. Keep your steps light.
I ran the stairs again, trying to keep my knees high.
I can feel you scowling.
I coughed and made a truly atrocious retching sound.
Knock it off!
Apologies if your heavy-footed lumbering puts a sour look on my otherwise perfect face. I pulled myself upright, reached for his cheek, dragged the corner of his mouth up with my thumb until he wore an absurd half-smile.
That's better. Still foul and unknightly, though.
Just the way you like me.
Rory nipped the pad of my thumb.
Now run it again.
The north wind picked up, and the rain with it. A storm was coming from the peaks, the clawed fingers of the mountains. I put a hand to my face and continued down the path to the village. I suppose that's an end to our training.
Hardly.
But it's going to storm.
All the more reason to practice. If you're thinking it will be sunshine and clouds 3 days hence,
he chuckled to himself, you're dreaming. The stairs were just the warm-up. The true training began on an upland, about a mile from the village, away from the intrusive stares of fishermen or the curious knighthood. Sparring.
First things first.
Rory bit the finger of his glove and peeled it off.
How well can you actually see through that shroud?
I can see just fine, he threw his glove. It smacked me on the nose and plopped to the stones at my feet.
A vision issue? Rory pondered, or just slow reflexes.
I picked up the glove, strangled it in my fist. Neither.
Uh-huh.
He appraised me, rotating on the balls of his heels.
It's a problem, obviously. Forget it getting wet like it is now. You get blood on it. It's a blindfold, not a shroud. Then again, there's an advantage to hiding your eyes in combat. Makes it harder for your opponent to anticipate your...
I launched the glove. It struck Rory's chin. He caught it as it fell, a flash of something wicked in his eyes.
At least your aim is sufficient.
I'm keeping it on, I said. End of discussion.
Fine, forget the shroud. Time for a happy encore.
He rolled his shoulders, squared off with me.
Hit me, diviner. Hit me as hard as you can.
I ran my tongue along the inside of my mouth and rushed him. There was a flicker of stone, the echo of a ping. Rory disappeared, and I crashed through air, legs pinwheeling. He appeared 3 feet away, caught his coin, smiled.
That's not fair. You're about to go toe-to-toe with a creature far less courteous than me. You saw how the harried scribe attacked us even after he'd been defeated. No honour among thieves, and even less among gods. The oarsman's not going to fight cleanly. He'll stand in that hall, near his pool, and spin you in circles. Even if you pull away from the water and deny him his advantage, that oar grants him substantial reach. He'll use it to beat you down. Your job is to anticipate him.
The coin soared through the air. Wrestle it away from him. Rory was several feet away once more. Once you're in close, use that strength of yours and throw him down.
I tried again and again to hit him. Every time I imagined I could anticipate his next move, Rory flickered away, slapping his glove against my arm or shoulder or back.
Think of it like dancing. Read your partner's body. Predict it. The rain and the coin made a specter of him. You liked dancing, as I recall, at Coulson.
I liked putting you in the dirt more. I was gasping, knees aching, heavy on my feet, striking out wildly, wasting my strength on blows that meant nothing but air. It took no effort for Rory to throw the coin over my head, appear behind me, and send me sprawling with a single push.
Come on, Diviner! Move those flat feet!
When he sent me sprawling a second time, I slapped the ground.
Again.
But I couldn't catch him, and the rage of that made me even clumsier.
Are you embarrassed to be bad at something? Rory asked. Or just embarrassed to be bad at it in front of me?
Fuck you!
Don't take it so personally.
He flickered away. This time, I didn't chase him. But it is personal. The craft of divination is a lie, and for 10 years, I was its most devoted student. If there are no gods, then being their harbinger means nothing. I was never important. Being scared and tired and ill was for nothing. I drowned for nothing. My hands, my voice, shook. And now the diviners are gone, and it is up to me to find them because no one else is searching. It's all personal, this business with the omens. You of all people should know that.
Rory had stopped throwing his coin. He stood opposite me, hair in his eyes, soaked by rain, the muscles in his jaw bunching.
I sprang forward. The coin never had the chance to leave his hand. I was already there, crashing into him, arms around his waist, shoulder in his diaphragm. I bared my teeth, muscles screaming, and hurtled the both of us onto the ground. I didn't know where to put my hands, but there was a beast in me, and when Rory hit the stone with a sharp exhale, coin in his fist, I slammed his wrist to the ground, clambered over his body until I was astride his chest, took my other hand and pressed it over his throat.
Can't you understand? It's all been personal. Neither of us did anything but pant, our breaths muting or transmuting the ire between us. I looked down at him through a rain-soaked shroud, and he up at me through impossibly dark eyes, and for that moment, we were his coin. Two sides, perfectly balanced. His speed, my strength, like it was chance, only chance, that had determined which of us had come out on top. Rory's throat hitched under my palm. His wild pulse was everywhere, in his neck, his chest, in my own body.
All right, he said, his voice grating out of him. It's personal. If I was any good at talking to you, maybe I'd have already said that, because it's personal for me too.
His eyes dropped to my mouth. It wasn't for nothing, Diviner. You are important. You're... He stopped himself, looked down at my arm over his neck, grinned.
You should know, if you're going for the throat.
Rory caught my arm with his free hand and wrenched me forward until it was my forearm, not my palm, pressing against his neck. Up close is better, more control, less room for him to hit you or knock you aside.
Embers stoked his voice.
Lean forward.
My thighs flexed around his ribs.
I'll choke you.
As if you haven't imagined 1,000 ways to strangle me.
He bucked his hips, and my weight shifted forward, my chest falling flat over his, my forearm pressing into his throat.
Good.
Rory's breath caught.
Just like that.
Rain sluiced from my hair, falling down my nose, over the curve of my mouth, then dropping onto his. I looked down at his lips, and he up at mine,
the distance between us eclipsing like a celestial movement, staggering and inevitable. I could feel the plane of his body, and the moment it hardened. Rory flushed. Slowly, his left hand rose to my face. He hooked my chin with his thumb and pressed, parting my lips directly over his. Then he was pushing up, his mouth ghosting over mine. "You two still sparring?" someone called over the rain. "Or have we shifted tactics?" I jerked back. Benji and Maud stood paces away. The gargoyle was there too, poking raindrops out of the air.
"I'll say, Bartholomew," he said distractedly. "Are you quite well?"
I peeled myself off Rory faster than I'd run my warm-ups. "I'm fine."
"I meant that, Bartholomew."
The gargoyle flicked a stone finger at Rory.
"The knave looks undone."
Rory was still lying on the ground, breathing hard, eyes unfocused. I watched his chest rise and fall, and then he was scraping a hand over his face, rising to his feet, and coming to stand next to Maud and the king. I noticed then how rigid Maud stood, how low her brows were over her green eyes.
3 days isn't much time.
Benji was red around the nose and wearing an extra cloak, like he hadn't yet warmed from being in the water during the ceremony.
"We'll get her ready."
From his pocket, he withdrew the Harrod scribe's inkwell, smiled at me.
"By any means."
Maud's features twisted in a knot. "That's her weapon, scalding ink against an oar." I could hear the doubt in her voice. It felt like a sign, a portent, a terrible omen.
"I've a better idea."
Rory held out his hand under her nose, the artful brigand's coin waiting in his palm. He turned his gaze to me. There was still a hint of red in his cheeks.
"Do you know how to skip a stone, diviner? Throw it flat."
"Yes." He beckoned me forward. When I reached into his palm and took the coin, I was surprised by how heavy it was. Rory rounded my body. "There are two rules to that coin. Rule one, throw it with the smooth side up, and the coin will transport you to any place you toss it. You won't touch anything, walls, doors, even your opponent. You'll be like a ghost." "And the other side?"
"More aggressive than a ghost,"
Maud deadpanned. Satisfaction stole over Rory's face. "Rule two, throw the coin the rough side up. It will break through anything it encounters until it loses momentum, but you'll have to chase after it, so make the throw count." I turned the coin over in my palm. "So if I were to throw it rough side up, let's say, at your head, you'd be picking the pieces of my brain off Benji's cloak. Not much of a mess then." Maud went to stand opposite me across the yard. "Toss it toward me, Six. Not through me, mind. Smooth side up. Toss it so you're standing on my left." I looked down at the coin.
"Don't worry, Bartholomew," the gargoyle called. "If you accidentally kill her, I will not be upset."
"I will."
Benji's blue eyes widened. "Just be careful."
"Everyone, shut up."
Rory's eyes were on me, a challenge toying within them.
"Let it fly."
I hauled in a breath, swung my arm, my wrist, let loose the coin, and disappeared. It was just like at Ashling when Rory and I had slipped through the cottage door. Speed and nothingness. I disappeared, my body eclipsed by rain and wind in an exhilaration akin to dancing. And then my hand was out, catching the coin. I rematerialized at Maud's side. I'd hoped to impress her, but there was still doubt in Maud's voice.
"Again."